Good morning. 6 after 10. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Continuing with our look back at the naughties, as some are calling them, we're going to talk about the top news stories of the decade, and we're going to talk about how our language has changed over the past 10 years, because that's had an impact on how we think about the news and how we talk about it. Your spell checker may still choke on it, but Web 2.0 is now part of the English language, and that's just one example. We now have more than 1 million words in English, and we're adding 14 new ones every day. So, we have a lot to talk about this hour. I'll give the phone numbers right off the top. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Paul Pack, President and Chief Word Analyst at the Global Language Monitor. He's also the author of A Million Words and Counting, How Global English is Rewriting the World. He was also one of 5 experts asked by the BBC to contribute to a snapshot of the last 10 years. A part of that effort was to track word usage as a means of identifying the top stories and trends of the past decade. Good morning, Paul, and welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, tell me about the Global Language Monitor. What is that exactly?
Okay, basically, 10 years ago, I co-founded YourDictionary.com. YourDictionary.com is still the largest multilingual dictionary site on the web. It has 230 different languages on it. And what we found was that the news media and different companies and things of that nature were very interested in finding out what was the story behind the story with how words were being used. So we became interested in how political buzzwords were tracked and things of that nature. So what I did is I spun off Global Language Monitor 7 years ago just to track language usage in global English around the world, and that's what we've been doing. So what we do is we look at the language as a single entity, you know, so it can be coming from China, English, or coming from India, English, etc. And what we do is we look at the different aspects of culture that are impacted by language and vice versa, like the movies, okay, like things like that, but like politics. I mean, it's always interesting to see how a buzzword works through this way in politics. How does something become a buzzword, and then how does it end up, and how does it affect the public mind? So basically, yep, what we do is we analyze what's going on in English and how it impacts various areas of culture.
Give an example of a buzzword that developed.
How about in politics? It could be Swift voting. Swift voting. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, nobody even knew what a Swift vote was, and all of a sudden, it's a verb. Okay. So, a Swift voting, flip flop, is something that's, and basically a buzzword can be something as simple as quagmire, right? And a quagmire, you trace back to the 16th century, and what it means is you're on quaking ground, like you're in a swamp, and it kind of quakes. That's a quagmire. It gets during the Vietnam War, somehow became the word to describe being in an intractable situation, and so then we saw with the run-up to the Iraq War that within months it was being used to describe what was going to happen in Iraq. It was going to become a quagmire. Okay, and so that's how a word goes, or flip-flopping, right? Somebody says he flip-flopped, and all of a sudden, flip-flopping is a bona fide political term, and we all know what it means. So we all know what the hot buzzword means. It may not be accurate, and people may use it to their advantage and to torpedo what a foe thinks or whatever. But another one was out of the mainstream. We noticed in the 2004 election, anybody that you didn't like was out of the mainstream. So it'd be interesting. We'd be reading that there's a such and such a bill coming up before Congress, and it's 80% of the people in the U.S. back it. And then you'd hear the opposition say, well, it's out of mainstream thinking. And it's like, isn't it by definition mainstream meaning mainstream? And it just becomes a political phrase that becomes hot. And it's actually negative to political debate, right? It actually hurts political debate. Because you don't have to think anymore. You just go from, well, he's a flip-flopper, well, he's out of mainstream, blah, 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 and you go on from one buzzword to another, and you had a nice conversation that was completely meaningless.
Well, and there are so many words that are just thrown around for no apparent reason, words like synergy and things like that, that to me have all the meaning of the word Kleenex. You know, there's right. nothing, there's just nothing there. I remember being in a one-act play when I was in high school called Right You Are, If You Say You Are, Obscurely, and the play was nothing more than conversations made up of buzzwords. And this was a long time ago, but we've had buzzwords for a long time. I could spend the entire hour talking about language, but the original reason that we wanted to talk to you today was because of this project you worked on for the BBC to determine the top news stories or events or trends of the last decade. And you used a rather interesting way to develop your list of the top stories. So why don't you tell us about that?
What we do is we try to do things based in some type of fact, right? I mean, our motto is you start from reality and then you can go from there. But you start from reality. And so what we did is, and this is 7 years ago, we developed this thing called the PQI, which is just a predictive quantities indicator. And what we do is we actually go to the web and go to different databases. So you might have something like a news site, you know, proprietary news sites like Factiva, right, which is all the main newspapers in the world. Or you go to Google as an idea, or you go to the Chinese websites and things of that nature. And basically what we do is we track to see how many times different words and phrases are used over periods of time. And so when we looked at what was being done, and actually they came to us, the BBC, because they saw that we created the top news stories of the decade already. And they liked the methodology, and so they asked us to use that methodology for the words. And they had people around the globe sending in words, nominating words that they thought would be indicative of what happened over the years, and that would show what happened in news stories and things of that nature. So basically, we find relevant words or phrases, and it's a pretty simple way to do it. And basically, we get raw numbers, and then we put them through our series of algorithms and just see really what was used the most and what was used the second most. And we do this because, you know, in language, people have all these opinions, but it's really never fact-based, right? They say, well, this is the right way to say it, or this is the wrong way to say it. One of our things I like to say is let the web decide, right? So is irregardless a word? It's like, you bet irregardless is a word. It's used, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of times every day, but is it proper? Well, that's a different question. But I mean, is it a word that people use and people understand and things of that nature? And yes, it is. Is it a proper word?
It's like the word orientate.
Orientate, exactly. Well, I use the one that when a boat runs aground, right? It's founders, right? A ship of state founders, right? And now people say flounders. And I'll be reading the New York Times and it will say this bill, you know, in Congress is floundering. And so for a while, people would call and say, well, is that a word? And it turns out that you'll see major dictionaries are accepting floundering as a word. You know, and I mean, I would think, is this ship of state, you know, flopping around like a cod, you know? It's like, no, yeah. It's floundering. It got stuck, right? But no, now floundering is considered the same definition as the original founder.
So we could have the founding never mind. I'm not even.
The founding fathers.
Yeah, the founding.
Well, that's another thing. You know, we have the political correctness. We measure political correctness from all sides just to kind of show what happens. And it's like, you know, you can't, you know, so we'll have like the 10 most egregious points of political correctness. And it's interesting because we'll get people from the right saying like, why are they doing that? And people from the left going, why are they doing that? Because it offends everybody, right? Because both sides use political correctness to their own advantage. And so it's always fun to do political correctness. And then you have certain whole terms that can't be used anymore. And one thing we found last year, that political correctness is becoming a politically correct term. That is becoming a hot term. Like if you say politically correct, all of a sudden it means all this other prepackaged stuff in your mind,
bad.
Right?
Yeah. So. Well, let's talk about some of the stories that you discovered through your word search the way your methodology worked. It was interesting. And again, you know, being from the United States, I probably look at the world in a unique way from somebody in a way that's unique from someone who's, say, in France or some other country. But the rise of China, the biggest story of the decade, outdistancing the number two internet story by 400%.
Right. And what we do is we look at the internet per se. So it's the internet, the blogosphere, and now Twitter and social media, that type of thing. And then we look at the mainline, the top 50,000 print and electronic media shows. Like, so anything has a database. If you have a database, Wisconsin Public Radio, and you do, you're clowning in that, right? We search every database we can. And we were really surprised that what you have to do is find, like, relevant terms, right? How did you capture the rise of China, right? So we tested all these different terms, and the one that we caught was the rise of China. Okay, that was the one that told the story that you could search on and things similar to it, and you could get rid of other things that are too similar to it but don't have different meaning. But, you know, so basically you're focusing on something like the rise of China. And it turned out to be at 400% more stories than the next internet story. That's big.
And the next internet story was the Iraq War.
The Iraq War. And so now in the mainline media, the Iraq War was number one, rise of China was number two. But when you combine them for our total index, it's rise of China. Now, do you have time for a little story about the rise of China?
Please do.
Okay, it's kind of interesting. It's like we started an international incident by doing that, okay? And if you go to languagemonitor.com, you can follow the whole incident, okay? But basically, what happened is that we had, you know, a press release, and it got picked up by Reuters and people like that, and so it was all over the place. And so People's Daily, which is the official, you know, communist language organ, runs the story about, you know, the rise of China and everything else, and that's cool. The next day, China Daily comes out with an analysis of our story and how that what we are doing, and they had all these scholars and people from think tanks and political organizations and things comment that what our story showed was the U.S. media's attempt to change China's position in the world, to burden them with responsibilities of a first world country when they're really still a third world country with 250 million people making less than $100 a year, et cetera, and that it's all tied into Helsinki, et cetera, and how they expect China, which is one of the great carbon producers, right, that China to reduce its carbon consumption basically like the United States and France and, you know, other developed countries. And whereas it's a third world country, and it has to, you know, the third world country gets some leeway and aid from the first world countries. And so we saw when President Obama went over there and he was negotiating at that table with 15 other leaders, the Chinese premier was not there. There was a delegate that would go out of the room, talk to the Chinese premier, and then come back, that type of thing. And so they did exactly what they said in this story. And so anyhow, so what happens is, so we have the original story, then we get this thing, and it's called China Daily the next day, the official English paper in China, and it's called The Rise of the Dragon. Now, that's interesting, because we were doing Rise of China. In China, they call it The Rise of the Dragon, they're the dragon, okay? So then we get a report, then I get a call from the Wall Street Journal, Beijing's bureau, and says, so is it true? Are you head of this worldwide conspiracy of Western media to force China into this? And I said, well, you know, if it was, it was kind of interesting, but this is what we did. So there's this huge story there. Then the Financial Times picks up the story. Then the Chinese Economic Review comes up with this thing called the hard bigotry of too high expectations, kind of like, you know, kind of pointing out the absurdity that people are excited about the rise of China, and that's why there's 80% of the stories are positive. And then it ends, this is really hard to believe, the People's Daily does a review of the Chinese ambassador to the UK who gives a speech at the English-speaking Union that, you know, Churchill founded and all that, and mm-hmm. It's the official speech, which is the official response to Global Language Monitor's what we did and why it doesn't make sense, and so that was the official thing. It's still going on. But it's like,
well, you
we
know,
were on Chinese television, it's like, yeah, and it's all tied to, what about you know, you're always trying to get these civil rights into the story, and you're always pointing this out. And so what I did is I said, here's what we see from the data. And I just told them the data, and it was fascinating.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, we could help the Chinese as a third world country, but we'd have to borrow the money from them to do it.
Well, that's the problem. Somebody's trying to come up with this term, Chi-America. Chi-America has, you know, China and the U.S. tied, but it's not really catching on. And I don't think, I think it doesn't really, well, it doesn't say what we want to say, Chi-America.
So you could call it a chimera and or a chimera, and then it would just keep changing all the time.
That'd be cool.
All right. Well, we need to get to a break, and then we've got some phone calls to take. And we invite you to call and email and talk about the ideas that have been kicked around for the last 10 years. We're talking kind of we're kind of all over the place this hour, but I think that's OK. It's been an interesting discussion about how language has shaped the news stories that have been or the events that have been the major forces in the last 10 years. We invite you to participate as well. Here's how. The phone number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just about 24 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Damian Jakes is in for Ben Marins today, and after 4 o'clock, they'll be talking about how 2009 proved to be a roller coaster ride of economic challenges. TARP, bankruptcy protection for GM, cash for clunkers. More than 1 in 10 people lost their jobs last year. After 4, join Damian Jakes and his guest for a 2009 economic review and the outlook for 2010. This hour, we're taking a look back at the last 10 years through the eyes of language and how that shaped the events that occurred and how it shaped our perception of the events that occurred during this first decade of the 21st century. My guest is Paul Payak, President and Chief Word Analyst for the Global Language Monitor. By the way, you can look at their website. It's www.languagemonitor.com, language monitor, all one word. He's also the author of A Million Words and Counting, How Global English is Rewriting the World. We've got some phone calls to take. Before I go to that, I wanted to ask you, so we crashed the 1 million word barrier. What was the millionth word to add to the English language?
Well, you know, when we did this, we nominated one word from each area we follow. And so there were about 25, 30 words. And unfortunately, this was not our favorite, but what came up mathematically was Web 2.0.
So that's a word.
Oh, yeah, it's like a 3D word.
My spell checker doesn't agree with you.
Your spell checker has made my Microsoft like the most inferior word site on the planet, so I would not use a spell checker to agree. I think they have, let's say they have 80,000 words, there's a million. There's a lot that's not there.
I was indulging my penchant for irony. I apologize.
It's like one thing I learned early that irony doesn't work on the web, but it does, sometimes it works on the radio, and I actually saw that, but I just wanted to give a little dig to the spell checkers, because that's how most people, like, they don't go to dictionaries anymore. They go to spell checkers, which are really, you know, just not up to snuff.
Well, you know, the dictionary's gotten so big they're hard to lift. So,
it's like we have an essay called "Is Webster's Merriam-Webster's its own best frenemy," right? And what it is that Merriam-Webster comes out to the Collegiate Dictionary and they announce the new words that they're putting in the dictionary. So what we did is we analyzed the 100 words wherever they put in with their own data. Like we went to their unabridged dictionary and saw that the average age of the words that they were putting in the dictionary was 23 years. So what happens is you have kids, you know, in Wisconsin, or you know, on the planet, looking at words like dark energy, dark matter, you know, and it wasn't even put in until last year. You go to Google, there's 9 million different stories on dark energy and dark matter, but they didn't recognize it as a word because they're, you know, they're kind of stuck in a 18th and 19th century on how a word becomes a word. It takes like a generation to become a word, and nowadays it's born and forgotten well before a generation, right?
Well, I mean, there are probably a lot of words we were using in the 1990s that just nobody uses anymore, except people who are stuck in the 90s, perhaps.
But the key is, if it's in the literature of the 90s, if it's in the newspapers of the 90s, if it's on the television in the 90s, it's just like the King's English, like Shakespeare. You need to have all the words in Shakespeare in your dictionary so you can go back and read about 1593, right? And so if it's in the literature, if it's in the magazines, if it's in novels and things like that, then it's an official word in the English language, open.
Forsooth. Let's take a call from Hugh in Milwaukee first. Hugh, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Morning. I was very fortunate to live in China for 2 years. Things were so much better than I had anticipated. But let me say one thing. I was teaching English there. And I found that there were very few words in the English that I know that are derived from Chinese. China as a nation may be rising, but I don't see where it has affected American and probably not British English that much. That's point one. Number two, you were talking about flip-flops before. And this reminded me of changes in meaning. You know, when I was young, you would put something on your feet, a kind of sandal, and you called it a thong. But but now, if I still use that word, and people look askance when I use it, because their meaning is a skimpy kind of bathing suit. In fact, I think Rush Limbaugh, I was told, had the solution to people who put bombs in their under underwear, yeah, make everybody wear a thong. And of course the conspiracy about Copenhagen, of course, is the whole global warming nonsense. It's a myth to begin with, but that's another story. And if America pays China, it's just insane. But there is no global warming. And it's a scam. But I hope at one point you'll have a lot of stories on this hoax that's been put upon the world so that America and the West will give more money to China and India and so forth. But not only are there words, they change in their meaning.
Hugh, right, thanks for the call.
Okay, go on.
Where did climate change rank in your findings?
Well, climate change, global warming, slash, right, is the number one phrase of the decade. Okay, whenever we would do and so that's both sides of the political spectrum, right? Because basically, global warming means to the political elite, okay, or to the newspapers, whatever. Climate change means that humans are responsible for it. Excuse me, that it's a natural thing, and global warming is caused by humans. And so you look at both ways. Our top word of the decade was global warming, and our top phrase was climate change. And again, you know, you can have lexical pairs as words, you know, so you can argue about that, but global warming, and it's interesting, because every time we do a political analysis, every time since 2004, if we put in climate change or global warming or anything with green in it, it pops the top. And so the New York Times during the 2008 election said, we had a couple of the famous columnists like Friedman and people like that. They both said, come to Global Language Monitor to see how the buzzwords are being used nowadays. And we would analyze the speeches. And we had one speech where we were famous for that Sarah Palin had a higher grade level than Barack Obama, I believe. And so that's just because his speeches are well thought out. And hers was kind of random, so it was harder to understand, is what that meant.
Let's go back to Hugh's first point, though, about what the Chinese may or may not have contributed to the English language. English is as a language is well, it's primarily its roots are in Europe, but we would expect that as there have been a lot of global influences on English in the last 10 years. What have the Chinese contributed to our language, if anything?
We see that they are contributing, and more than that, is at the end of my book, a million words and counting. I actually go into seven different scenarios for language, for the English language 400 years from now, okay? And so 400 years is how far we are from Shakespeare, so that's a reasonable amount of time. And one of the scenarios is that China, the Chinese take over English and they own it. You know, it goes from the King's English to right to the American English, which is 60% of the world now, American English. And then China becomes the main generator of the English language and actually starts to own it, and that's because it's become this economic language, right? It's the language of science, economics, education. I mean, we're also finding out that when studies are done around the world, is that when kids study English, by kids I mean anybody younger than anybody college age or younger, okay? When young people study language, English, they don't do it to sound like President Obama. They don't want to sound like the Queen. They don't want to sound like Bono or somebody. They want to be able to communicate with other people their age in their own area. So people study, there's 250 million people studying English right now in China. In 1960, there were 250 million English speakers globally. So that's now there's 1.5, 1.6 billion English speakers in that China. So people are studying English in China. So because it's easier to communicate if you have a business deal in Singapore or in Shanghai, and then in the western precincts of China or in Korea, it's better just to do it in English than have to use the various other languages. And so even in China, it's easier to use English than different dialects. And so in that case, it's bigger than just individual words. Though we do see words coming through, it's the question of where does the language itself head over the next several generations. It's a very adaptable language.
Hugh, thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul next in Duluth. Oops, I'm sorry. Yep, Paul in Duluth. Good morning.
Happy New Year. Are you there?
Yep.
Oh, hey, I've got a couple of points for your guest. First of all, I think my favorite word that I've heard in the last couple of years is snarky. Because, I mean, you almost instinctively know what it means. But I was wondering if the guest is familiar with the Lake Superior College list of words that need to be shelved for a while.
Yes.
They put out their
very, very interesting. Yeah, it's very.
They put out
list.
Their list every year, and Wisconsin Public Radio has been doing a show on it. I haven't heard one yet this year, but they came up with things like shovel ready, teachable moment, and app. As words that are really tired and need to be retired.
Right, and we love that list. And last year, I haven't seen this, but it was quoted in various media that they had the millionth word that we came up with because economists and different media were saying we're going to come up with this word as ready to be retired as soon as it comes out because whatever it is, it's used way too much. But anyway, we love that list because it's very clever, and that's been around for 20 or 30 years, and it really predates all these other lists. We were the first dictionary-related site to actually come up with top words of the year, and then you have the American Dialectical Society that's been doing it for 20 years, but that's a bunch of eggheads deciding what are interesting to them, right? And what we try to do is reflect what real people are saying. So snarky has been around from our study of it since 1906. Okay, so it's been around, but it's taken on a whole nother life lately.
Yeah, what did it mean in 1906?
Well, it meant snarky. Okay.
Well,
it was really interesting when you do something like the old words like Twitter, right? What did Twitter mean 400 years ago? What meant tweet? Right? And so let me just see if I can find an old definition.
While you're looking,
testy, irritable. And it originally looks like it came from German to snore.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It would be like snorkin. Okay? You can see how things, it's like what happens in English is that we mix, we just accept everything. In France we have, the Academy Française saying what can be a word and what can't be a word. In English, we just say, come on in, come on in. It's a people's language. Anything that people say is a word. We don't say bling isn't a word because it came from the wrong source or something. If people use bling, if I understand it, you understand it, it's in the dictionary. That's how it works. It's descriptive, not prescriptive.
But what we've just seen here, though, is the problem, one of the inherent problems in defining words, because you define one word in terms of other words. You use words to define words, and ultimately what we're looking for is meaning, and that rests in people, not in words.
Yes. So what does that mean?
I have no idea what I just said. It sounded really good.
When we did the a million word count, we had 10,000 stories about it minimum around the world, right? And we had four or five linguists that were furious about us trying to count words, because since you can't define what a word is, how do you count it? And it's like, so we just defined the word as, you know, if two people can say it and understand it, if it appears enough times regionally and geographically, so it has to have a depth, meaning it can't just be in a ghetto, it can't just be on the Upper East Side, it has to be that people understand it, you know, in Beijing, they need to understand it. They need to understand it. You know, snarky. They need to understand it in L.A. They need to understand it in South Africa. They need to understand it geographically. It also has to appear in different types of recorded language, so in the media, in stories, and songs, and things of that nature. And so it's just how you define words. And so the two or three linguists were there, like, since you can't define a word, you can't count a word. And we'd say things like, well, how many words are in OED? And they say, like, 700,000. I said, aren't you counting those words? Yeah, but that doesn't count. It's just like, you know, there's so many ideas that, you know, there's all this linguistic theory that says, you know, I just said to you. But how many words is I just said to you? You might think naively that it's five. I might think that it's five. But that just shows how naive we are, that we aren't really understanding true language and how many other intellectual processes are playing out there. And so so we just said, fine, we're counting words. Okay, if I say it and you pronounce it, if I pronounce it, you understand it, it's a word. That's what the old English thought, the Middle English. That's it.
Okay. Paul from Duluth, thank you for calling. I always enjoy hearing from you. Let's take one more call quickly before we go to a break, and we'll talk to Virginia in New Berlin.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for having a program on language.
Well, you're welcome.
My problem is what people are doing with the letter A, and when it has that flat sound like black or axe, they're saying block, ox, pockers, and I'm wondering why that's happening. For an old lady, it just changes the language something fierce.
We're changing the use of the letter A.
Yes.
Right. Well, you know, when you read look at a dictionary and how's the pronunciation, there's something called a schwa, right? And a schwa is like an upside down at sign, okay? And that is the indeterminate vowel sound that everything kind of, it's kind of what you're talking about, is that this is kind of like an A, but it's kind of like an E. It kind of mixes different sounds. And so dictionary people just get around it by putting a schwa in there, meaning it can be anything. And so, literally, I believe the easiest way to look at it is that the schwa, the pronunciation, is moving in different ways. And, I mean, this is another thing. It's a living language. And one of my theories is that a language is actually alive, meaning that, you know, it reproduces, it grows, it shrinks, it, you know, all sorts of things. But it's like we're not in control of the language. It's like, it's almost like a living entity. And so, you know, you go back to Middle English, and there was this thing called the Great Vowel Shift that nobody ever understands, but within terms of a generation or two, the whole language was pronounced differently. Okay? And so these things are precedented, but again, a dictionary's responsibility is to reflect how things are pronounced, not how they should be pronounced. Okay, that's English teacher's responsibility.
Well,
but if enough people pronounce it in this odd way, then the odd way becomes the mainstream way.
Well, but the word A, I mean, when you use the word A, not the letter A, but when you use the word A, the pronunciation is determined by what follows it.
Yes.
And we don't, I don't even want to get into that because grammar gives me such a headache. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll have some more discussions. I want to talk some more about some of the top stories as determined by, the method that we've been describing here for the last 42 minutes. Want to get to some more of those and your calls. We've got some interesting calls with some great questions coming up after the break. You could be one of them if you call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned for Larry Mueller after 11 o'clock. If you could pick any restaurant in Wisconsin for a wonderful meal, what would it be? After 11, Larry Mueller talks with Mary Bergen, a Madison travel writer and author of Hungry for Wisconsin. That's after 11 this morning. Well, that's going to make me look forward to lunch. Right now, we're talking about, well, we kind of started out talking about the top ideas or news stories of the decade, but because language is so much a part of how that's determined, this has sort of evolved into a language discussion, which is just fine with me because I love language and words and so forth, and so that works. I hope it's working for you. We've got quite a few callers, so I'm assuming it's working for everyone else. My guest is Paul Payak, President and Chief Word Analyst at the Global Language Monitor. He's also the author of the book, A Million Words and Counting, How Global English is Rewriting the World. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Sharon in Duluth. Sharon, good morning.
Hi, thanks. I'm a great Scrabble player, for one thing. So I catch some of these new words, like, but they sort of drive me nuts, like ZA for pizza. But my question was, some of the things that you're saying, okay, this is a new word, to me sounds like a phrase made up of two or three words. And so I'm kind of puzzled about that being said as a word. I wanted to remember what I was going to use as an example.
Well, climate change was climate change and global warming.
Right.
Paul, you said one of those was a word and one was a phrase, but how do you determine which is which?
Well, really, if you have two things like that, it's called a lexical unit. And that's been accepted, dry earth, right? You know, the word earth itself comes from Proto-Indo-European, which means dry ground, dry land, okay? And so things that are actually two words have been accepted as words, like three-dimensional, right? That's a lexical unit. You wouldn't say 3D is not a word. It is a word, right? And so they've been accepted at least since Samuel Johnson's dictionary. And so a word usually is sort of as one thing, and you know, it can be a lexical unit, so, and you can use them as phrases or words. And in the case of climate change, global warming, since they're both words and phrases, that's why we did it, so people would know that they're both, right? And but you're right. It's like, but you know, there's languages like German that you just invent new words by putting all the other words together, right, to describe one word. And so there's many languages like that. So it's not an unusual thing in language. It's a little bit unusual in English, but it's you know, everything's happening. Everything's getting conglomerated more and more with the English language.
Yeah, German is a great example of that, and I studied German briefly in college, and although I found the grammar easier to understand than English because it was better organized, some of the words that they have are real jaw-crackers. You have to take a breath in the middle of the word.
The town that's by the lily ponds by the bottom of the sea or whatever. And it's
right.
Like, that's one word, and it's like, yeah, but, yeah, like in German, like you say, or in Latin, I like reading the end of the sentence first so I know what we're talking about. That's kind of fun.
Throw mama from the train a kiss. Sharon, thanks for that call. This is our morning for Duluth callers, and that's, well, that's nothing wrong with that. Let's go to Peter in Stoughton next. Peter, good morning.
Good morning. You spoke earlier about words like irregardless and orientate becoming words, and I'm wondering about the viability of the word whom, whom. It seems to be more and more useless.
Well, very few people know how to use it, so that could be one reason.
I'm
yeah, And it is. I mean, that's what's happening. It's like in all of English, everything's getting simplified, right? And it's like, you know, we used to have something like 200 or 300 inflected nouns. So you have ox and oxen, right? And rhinos and rhinoceros, you know, when you rhinos in Greek, it's rhinos and rhinoceroi, right? Plural of rhinoceros. And in Greek, you know, it's O-S and then O-I. But now we just say things like rhino. Postmodern approach to language is to shorten everything and to combine things. So it's like really obvious when you're in the West Coast that everything, it's like I'm in NorCal. Oh, you're in Northern California. I'm in SoCal. I'm in Southern. Everything's combined. And it's the effort to make it easier to just say, and that's the thinking. Other cultures would like the longer words, but the current English culture is to shed the old words, shed the old grammar, and make things as simple as possible. So I think I like to use the word whom, but, you know, when you use the word herm, I actually said be spotted in a quote the other day, and people were shocked. Like, what does be spotted mean? And, you know, they're just used to saying things as plainly as simply as possible, which is actually a virtue, but they're not used to any of the old grammar that we love.
Thank you.
Well, Ed, I had an experience recently. I was substituting for another one of our talk show hosts on the Ideas Network, and one of the producers made a small wager with me that I couldn't work the word undulate into the conversation, and that took me about 10 seconds to manage that. But
that's a good one.
Yeah, the language is my mother. When I was a very little boy, my mother used to make me learn a new word every day. I had to be able to spell it and use it in a sentence. And so I grew up with a love of language, and I have been a champion of the precise use of language for years. And my family will attest to my getting on their case when someone would say, well, I'm going to jump in the shower. And I would say, don't do that. I didn't put down the little tacky strips yet. You might fall. Or, you know, I think I'll run to the store. And we have a perfectly good automobile in the driveway. You know, running might be healthy for you, but how are you going to carry the groceries back? So just stupid things like that. But
what about using two at the end of a sentence?
Oh, absolutely. A preposition is something you should never end a sentence with.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go to Barb and Marinette, who I think has another one of my pet peeves on her mind. Barb, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh,
go
I'm
ahead.
Doing very well. Okay, well, I get right down to the basics. There's a phrase that I find so annoying. I find myself saying it once in a while, but everybody else says it, and sometimes incessantly, and that is, you know. And it's crept into our vocabulary, and people are, I think, unaware that they're saying it. And I'm wondering, is this just in our country? Does it stretch beyond our borders? How did it get there, and when's it going to go away?
Well, there's always words like that people use. Like, a common one is okay, right? And so people will say, you understand what I'm saying, okay? And if you use okay with somebody else and watch the conversation, they will repeat. It's kind of like a yawn, right? They will repeat the word okay innumerable times before the conversation is done. But it's really just thought fillers, right? I mean, you have a space for a thought. And while you're thinking, I mean, if you're a trained speaker, you're trained when you have when you're in between thoughts to be silent. But the most common thing in American society is it's either you know or there's a lot of different ones that fill it, okay, and things of that nature. That you just when you're between thoughts, remain silent. That's a tough thing to do because it's like we're kind of like like on the air, right? You have to keep filling it, and that's what's happening. So it's really a matter of discipline. What do you think, John?
Well, we haven't found a way to sell dead air on the radio yet, but when we do, we'll probably have some. But yeah, that would is a filler. It's what people. It's sort of the I'm going to call it the caulk that goes in the seams of sentences.
Mm-hmm.
How's that for a metaphor?
It's kind of like a semicolon. You know, a semicolon says it's two related thoughts that are closely together. And I always use a semicolon as a mark of fine writing. If someone is actually thinking about a sentence, and these things are close enough that they're not distinct sentences, but they're related, so I put a semicolon in there. And when you think, is there a semicolon, you think, well, would I add the word and or but or something like that? Or you could do it this way. Would I add the word you know here, right? If you add you know, semicolon, then go on. So you just change it in your mind to semicolon, which is unpronounceable.
Okay. Barb, thanks for the call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We started out talking about events, and somehow this morphed into a discussion of our language pet peeves. Let's try to drag this thing back into some semblance of the topic we started. I noted that the death of Michael Jackson, which is something that occurred rather late in 2009, emerged as the number five thing that happened in the last 10 years, according to your research.
Yeah, that's amazing, because the death of Michael Jackson, it was almost embarrassing to a serious study on language and news and things like that, that it had such an incredible amount of story. So it's first of all, the top death recorded. You know, we record things like Princess Diana and Pope John Paul, and anytime there's a famous death, we try to measure how that impacts Ronald Reagan, et cetera. But the death of Michael Jackson was just incredible. I mean, it was just beyond belief, but it was sobering to see that in the mainline news, meaning print and electronic media, you know, radio shows, things of that nature, the death of Michael Jackson was third or fourth. It's on the internet where he was in overabundance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that we would think, it's like Obama, it's like you think in terms of short-term and long-term news. So as a short-term news story, the election of Obama was one of the top ever, okay? And that's because it was such a global story. So if we took the election of Obama and 6 months around it versus, you know, 6 months following it and versus, like, 9-11, we saw that 9-11 was more of a Western news story. So, of course, it had news and everything in Indonesia and, you know, other places like that. But the election of Obama was huge around the world. And so that was interesting to see that some stories are global, even things that are earth-shaking to us, like 9-11, was more of a Western story than a global story. Michael Jackson turned out to be one of those global stories.
Kathy in East Troy, let's talk to you next. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. I hate to bring it back to language peeves, but I will.
Go ahead.
Okay. I am getting annoyed, and maybe it's a function of age, that the phrase "you're welcome" seems to be disappearing, and instead of saying "thank you" and the follow-up of "you're welcome," it is "no problem." And I've never understood why "you're welcome" has disappeared, and suddenly I'm presented with the joy of not creating a problem for someone.
Well, Kathy, thank you for bringing that up, because that's one of my all-time pet peeves. Not only people say "no problem," but you say "thank you," and then someone says "no, thank you." Well, what is this, Alphonse and Gaston? I mean, you know, hello. What about it? We don't say "you're welcome" anymore. Is that just dropping out of our language?
It's just this is how language evolves. I mean, it's interesting to see that I'm thinking about the F word right now, right? And so someone 100 years from now will look back at our literature and think, you know, to see, like, especially specific movies, and think, like, what is going on with that word? But what happens is the offensive words and the King's English and, of one generation becomes just normal speaking to another. I mean, for example, when I was growing up, you would never say "you suck." That sucks. Now kindergarten kids go, "that sucks." And kindergarten teachers say "that sucks." And it's a word that went from being offensive to being what little kids say. And so you're just watching the evolution of the language. And, I mean, it's like what I don't like is when people say "no worries" rather than "no problem," right? I mean, it's like "no worries." It's like, well, I wasn't worried about it to start with, you know?
Well, that's Australian. That's
well,
no worries,
right.
No worries, baby.
It's going to be irritating because you lose something with this. I mean, a thank you and "you're welcome," et cetera, has a whole, you know, a whole mindset behind it. And what we're seeing is that mindset is changing. That's the thing that becomes irritating.
Well,
you know,
no worries. That's,
even, go on.
No worries is Australian. We all got that from Crocodile Dundee.
Right. Yeah, but a good TV show. A popular TV show, all of a sudden that's the standard.
Right. Well, that was a motion picture, but we could do a whole other do a whole other show, another hour on how the media shapes our language and how movies shape our language. I mean, go ahead, make my day. I mean, all the phrases that we've picked up. But the clock is telling me that we're about out of time. I really appreciate. I'd like to have you on again when we can talk more about language. It's always a fascinating topic, and we're leaving with full phone banks, so our listeners obviously agree.
Okay.
We should have another conversation. So, but now when I say thank you, you will say,
"No worries." No worries, no problem, guy.
No, yeah, all right, fine, whatever.
Say
whatever.
Whatever, there's another one, right?
Yeah, anyway, thank you so much for an enjoyable hour. What a great way to end the year.
It was my pleasure. It was great. I'd love to do it again. Thank you.
All righty. Well, note to the producers. We want to have this fellow back. Paul Payak is president and chief word analyst at the Global Language Monitor. He joined us by phone. Rhonda Fanning produced this program, and Erica Janik did on-air production. Thanks to both of them for making this a great week for me, and I hope for you as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.